Ryan, I think you'd have to be not paying attention to know that there's some hurricanes going on right now. And frankly speaking, Ryan, I think about insurance almost immediately when I think about these situations. It's devastating for these people in Florida. But if you're thinking about insurance now because of things like these hurricanes, definitely consider reaching out to our guy, Bill Burns, at the insurance agency by Bill Burns.
Yeah, exactly. And if you ever think to yourself, who are the people that actually switch to him? You guys talk about it each and every week. One of your loyal listeners here to Go for Gridiron Radio is one. His name was Austin. I'm getting done doing KFN before the game. He says, hey, Ryan, I switched over to your dad. I saved $700. Saved $700 by switching to the Burns Insurance Agency. So whether you're thinking about your home, your auto, your UTV, ATV, whatever it may be, and you're thinking to yourself, I'm probably paying too much money, and this hurricane makes me think I got to make sure I got this buttoned up. Well, check him out, insurancebyburns.com, or email him today, insurancebyburns.com.
Welcome to another episode of Goal for Gridiron Radio. I'm Luke Viewer.
And I am GopherIllustrated.com publisher Ryan Burns, and we welcome you guys back to the Rose Bowl edition as your Golden Gophers for the umpteenth straight game in 2024, Luke. Make it incredibly interesting because they're incapable of putting together back-to-back complete game performances for whatever the reason is. But at the very end, for the second straight week, Max Brosmer leads them down the field to take the lead. And who else but the pride of Esco and Coy Parrish gets his fourth turnover in two games. The city of Los Angeles is going to ban him from future events with the way that he has been playing against them in a 21-17 victory. Back-to-back wins, the Gophers sweep Los Angeles. And joining us is my second cousin, Dinky Town Athlete's Own, my favorite Golden Gopher offensive lineman, and someone I was mistaken for multiple times in Pasadena this weekend, Derek Burns. Derek, how are you, and how is it being my doppelganger as a 6'4" Burns?
I'm doing really well, Ryan. I appreciate that. And it's good to be back and breaking down a game from the Rose Bowl, which is interesting. I know that the television crew really leaned into that on the broadcast, which was interesting, but looks like a lot of people made it out and had a great time from the posts on social media, et cetera. So excited to break this one down.
All right, let's get into this game. The Gophers win 21-17. Again, this was in the Rose Bowl against UCLA. Minnesota moves to 4-3 on the season, 2-2 in conference, and UCLA moves to 1-5, 0-4 in the conference on the season. Fellas, I think to summarize this game, it was a game of two halves once again. In the first half, the Gophers were outscored 10-0. And notably, again, Dragon Kessage misses another field goal that would have put points on the board for them. That was not the only blunder of the first half. But then the Gophers outscore UCLA 21-7 in the second half to win 21-17. This was a game, I think, that if you looked offensively, and arguably even maybe even defensively, neither of the units played well in the first half, and they started to click and had moments of brilliance in the second half. But I wouldn't even argue that it was a complete second half where they were just sheerly brilliant. But yeah, let's get into when the Gophers are on offense. I'll just highlight quickly some counting stats before we get into this again. Max Brosmer on the day, 26-37 for 193 yards, two touchdowns. Darius Taylor led all rushers with 16 carries for 30 yards. I think it's worth noting for you guys that the Gophers only rushed for 41 yards on the day. You have to give UCLA some credit there. And then Daniel Jackson had 10 receptions for 89 yards. 10 receptions capped a career high for Daniel Jackson. Jameson Gears also added 3 for 34, and Elijah Spencer had 3 for 25 and a touchdown. And then notably, Darius Taylor limited to 3 catches for 17 yards and a touchdown. So how do we make sense of this one, fellas? Derek, I'll kick it to you. I think we have to give UCLA some credit, especially on defense.
Well, that's where I was going to go. You know, you talked about the first half was left much to be desired, but actually I really feel like earlier in the season when the Gophers have been flat for a half, it's been more so just a lack of execution, a lot of mistakes. Yes, that was there to a degree, but upon the rewatch, I was really, I guess, surprised is the right word. I believe we have to give some credit to UCLA and their coaching staff. I think on both offense and defense, they had a really good game plan for Minnesota, a really good scheme. And, you know, the players played hard. I think they were, you know, in our pre-production meeting, we talked about them kind of playing like they were backed into a corner. That's what it felt like. But specific to the UCLA defense, they were full send with their linebackers on running down in distances from the beginning of the game. So they were run blitzing, particularly if Darius Taylor was in the game. They were run blitzing on every running down and distance play, downhill 100%, which made it really difficult for the offensive line. It made it tough for the running backs to get bounce anything, to get anything outside. And so there were some wonderful adjustments in the second half from Greg Harbaugh and the offensive staff that I think got them right back in the game. But they really struggled in that first half because UCLA was just, they had committed and scouted and said, if Darius Taylor's in the game, we're going after him. We're not going to let him beat us. And on running situations, that meant that they were downhill and, you know, they were, those linebackers were at the line of scrimmage from, you know, a quarter of a second after the snap.
I think for me with this offense from watching it live is I was so infuriated in the press box. Now, I don't know if I just feel that way because I got less than 2 hours of sleep between travel today and kind of the way it worked out with writing and transcribing after the game. But Luke, I know what happens to this offense when it goes bad, and it's the same two bleeping things every time, and they can't dig themselves out of the hole. What is it? Well, it starts up front. And Luke, do you remember what my number one key to this game was for Minnesota in the preview?
I haven't the slightest idea.
I'm so glad that you listened to me for years, and yet you can't remember what I said 72, 96 hours ago. It was, can Minnesota's offensive line put together back-to-back performances? Yeah. And the answer is no. And I cannot fathom for the life of me why an offensive line that has three seniors, multi-year starters, Greg Johnson has now a multi-year starter, Ashton Beers has played in enough games, but they just cannot put it together consistently. And it's a penalty here, a missed assignment there, no knockback, somebody falls down. It's just, I'm sitting here rubbing my temples because when this offense goes bad, like they did in the first half, you think about even that first drive, Luke, second play action, they pull Tyler Cooper across the line of scrimmage, simulate play action power, draws the linebackers up. There's Jamison Gears, and as a former collegiate tight end, this is the play that everyone dreams of as a college football tight end. You're running wide open up the seam. You split the safeties. Ball is perfect for Max Brosmer. He's got two steps on the safeties, and if he catches it in stride, which that ball was put perfectly, he might be still running. And it could have been a huge explosive, and instead it's dropped. So instead of first and 10, at the UCLA 30 or potentially a touchdown, it's third and 11. And here's the thing with this offense, just like any other college football offense, I would say 90% of college football offenses are going to fall into this same category. If it is third and forever constantly, that is a horrible place to be. This is not an offense that can operate consistently off schedule. But the thing that has me almost banging my table here is it continues to be self-inflicted bleeping wounds. It's drops. It's missed assignments. It's one thing here, one thing there. You look at some of the key plays in this game of why didn't Minnesota score more than 21 points. Look at some of the key sacks that Max Brosmer had to take that were right up the middle, where it's just a protection miss from someone up front. And if he's able to sit in the pocket there for an extra second, Lemeke Brockington's going to break open, or someone will, and it would have been something. And so, Derek, that's kind of where I want to start this thing is No points in the first half. No consistency in the first half. But why, for the life of me, are we now seven games in and now you head into a bye week and we can talk about potential changes. But what, and to your point, UCLA was doing some different things and they approached this exactly how I would have approached Minnesota's offensive line with the struggles that they have. But why can this offensive line just not put together consistent game to game, drive to drive, or even play to play sometimes?
Well, I know that in the game on Saturday, because UCLA was sending their linebackers, they were downhill quickly. There were a number of times on running plays where the offensive line is combo blocking to the linebacker, and there were a number of times on passing plays where you're passing off defenders and you have to get to the linebacker. And most of the time when you're, what you're talking about, Ryan, when there was a free runner, we'll call it, it's because they didn't get off their combo block quick enough. So they're starting and comboing the three technique or the five technique, and they hit the combo block. Well, they look up to go to the backer, and the backer's in the backfield. So he's making a TFL. He's getting a sack. So in the game on Saturday, it was a matter of they had to adjust, and I think they did to some degree in the second half, although it wasn't clean the whole second half either. But they had to adjust to the scheme that UCLA was bringing, which was, we're going to be disruptive in the front. We're going to come downhill and be disruptive against this offensive line because we don't think they can handle it. And it took them a half to adjust it, and they had some good schematic adjustments. But to answer your broader question, I mean, honestly, Ryan, if I had the answer.
You're a Big Ten offensive lineman here. Yeah. You are the one with the pedigree. So if you have a solution, I think myself and Luke, and I think every listener would love to hear it.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this offline. I think they could consider flip-flopping and moving some, even if it doesn't mean somebody else coming off the bench, moving these guys around a little bit. I look back to...
hypothetically, Greg Johnson back to guard and Ashton Beers, who is your number two center.
Yeah, I would consider that because I think people forget Greg is a very athletic kid. And he was a really good guard last year, and he struggled this year at center. And I know I had the same transition when I played. I understand that intimately. And center is a position where it's easier to lose leverage because you're farther up on the line of scrimmage. It's hard, the angles are tougher. You have the snap to take care of. Center is just tough. It's like most of the offensive line, it's not a glorious position. It's a thankless job, whatever cliche you want to throw at it. So it's just not easy. And he's an athletic kid. I completely understand why they moved him to center, because you need somebody with some twitch that can move. And he has that, but it's been a tough adjustment. And I'm not saying he's not cut out for center and that he can't make it happen, but we're over halfway through the season now, and it's not the combination blocking in those interior three is not getting better. So I would look at maybe flip-flopping, as you talked about, just to see how it looks. Maybe they're already doing that in practice. We don't know. But it might be something to look at, because I just think back to to last year and think, as you pointed out, there's a lot of these same guys here and a lot of guys with experience. So we're not in a position, thankfully, that we're saying, well, just, two or three of these offensive linemen just aren't good enough. They're not good enough to play in the Big Ten. This is what we have. We're dealing with injuries. That's not the situation here. It's something, there's tweaking that needs to be done, and there's certain things you can do schematically, but I think from a personnel standpoint, they should look at that, just because that might be, mixing that up might be, what it takes to get this straightened out.
All right. Another place that we can give UCLA credit, the few times that the Gophers were able to get guys in space, I thought they tackled pretty well in space too, especially their linebackers, especially one-on-one. So they deserve credit there. And I do agree that the scheme, they went about that the right way. The analogy to the they were playing with their backs against the wall was true. But ultimately, it's a sign of a good team when you're able to play poorly, but then rebound and find a way to win, right? So we have to focus on the good as well. And part of this, you have to credit the defense for putting the offense into opportune situations. But you know, in the third quarter, they're able to put up two touchdowns, one aided by an interception. We'll get into the defense here, but you know, when you get those opportunities, sometimes you just have to execute, and they were able to. You know, they had that third down was the touchdown to Elijah Spencer. Like, that was a great read by Max. Waiting, read the defense. The zone did not get out wide enough. He was able to just trot into the end zone. All in all, they found a way, Ryan, and that was very, very important.
Yeah, why does Minnesota win this game ultimately? They have three red zone possessions, and all three of them end in touchdowns. And that's where we talked about on the preview episode, Luke, if you remember back. UCLA was the worst red zone defense in the Big Ten coming into this game. They had allowed 75% of their red zone possessions to end in touchdowns, and because Harbaugh was able to find the end zone on all three, every Gopher fan that traveled to Pasadena, all 12 to 15,000 of you, went home very happy Gopher fans that night. But that's even where I think back to, if you want to start with the good, where would this team be without Max Brosmer? I mean, as important as Coy Parrish has been both on the defense and for fan morale and for everything there, I think about Max Brosmer in the sense of Minnesota is 4-3. And if there was another quarterback here right now, say from last year, without question in my mind, they are 2-5. Like, his ability to be unflappable in these waning moments of games, where if Dragon Kesich hits a field goal against North Carolina, we'd be talking about Max Brosmer already has three game-winning drives through seven games.
Yeah.
Now he's got two in back-to-back weeks, including in a second half where, for whatever the reason, Luke, Minnesota can now only score in the second half. They have to, in the first half, get all their self-inflicted wounds out of the way. And then in the second half, the offensive line decides to be more consistent in pass pro. The pass catchers don't drop passes. But we're talking about a second half in which Max Brosmer goes 16 of 21 with no turnovers and two touchdowns, including a couple of big spot throws on that final drive, including the smash concept into space out of the two-minute warning to Daniel Jackson for 27 yards, which you can't draw up that play any better for what Minnesota was looking for a look. And then even on the final play that Darius Taylor scores on, think about this play, and I don't know that it's getting talked about enough with this aspect. We talked about it in the group chat, boys. Daniel Jackson wasn't allowed to be on the field there.
Right.
On that second down, Minnesota takes an end zone shot to Daniel Jackson. It's incomplete. His helmet ends up coming off, which we...
There's not a good replay on that. I don't even really know what happened, but somehow it came off, and it's kind of suspicious.
I don't know too many plays in football often where a helmet comes off and there wasn't some sort of tomfoolery involved, but he has to come off the field, of which both in our group chat and also up in the press box. So Deshaun Foster, UCLA's head coach, calls a timeout before that third and goal play. And we start all talking about, well, can Daniel Jackson come back onto the field here? Because technically it's a stoppage. There's a timeout. And if you don't remember back, Minnesota actually tries to then throw Daniel Jackson back out on the field. They are told no. So it's Christian Driver who comes in motion from left to right. He's the first read. Brosmer looks to him immediately, decides no. Starts to work back towards the middle of the field where there's options 2, 3, and 4. It's a zone coverage, not a great spot. Brosmer is like, okay, well, let me get to my final read. And here's the important part about that final touchdown. For whatever reason, if you remember back to what Derek said to open this podcast, UCLA all night run blitzed or just blitzed. When Darius Taylor was in the game, they ran a linebacker up, which made Darius Taylor stay in pass pro. Well, I guess what they didn't do on that specific play. The motion took both linebackers. The linebackers didn't come. So what does Darius Taylor do? He gets to the line, sees that linebacker isn't on me, and he breaks away. He goes to the bottom. So the entire play is going to the right, all three receivers plus the motion man. And just as it's designed, Brosmer gets to his fifth read, hits Darius Taylor in stride, touchdown, ball game. I mean, when was the last time, Luke, we talked about a Gopher quarterback on the game-winning drive, getting to the fifth read, and that's the reason they win.
Well, and the thing that we should note, too, is he's, you know, relatively unfazed. The offensive line does hold up pretty well. There is decent pressure, but unfazed and stands into the pocket and is able to make a throw. And it's not just a throw. It's a dart, like, in stride. So, you know.
Can't place that ball.
No, you can't.
There's pressure around him. Now, I'm not here to tell you the offensive line played well. I think you've already figured out what I thought. But they do deserve their flowers on that play.
For
specifically,
sure.
Both tackles and then Tyler Cooper. They show like an all 22 view, so from behind. And Tyler Cooper gets a huge readjustment at the last second to stay in front of the interior pressure, which allows Max Brosmer, who his heart rate has to be at about 60. Like his heart rate isn't in the 150s like everybody else's was in the stadium. Calm, cool, and collected, works through his reads right to left. But because Tyler Cooper gets that readjustment, Brosmer is able to stand in the pocket, deliver an accurate throw. And when Max Brosmer is given a good pocket, good things are going to happen.
All right. Derek, I think we should go through the kind of the late sequence there. The Gophers prior to punting, I forget the exact time. It was like 2:40. When did they punt with 6 minutes left? Let me look. I'm so sorry. I didn't have this pulled up.
So they get the ball back with 6:54 left. They have a six-ish play drive.
Yes.
And then they end up punting from the UCLA 47.
Yes.
With 2:53 left and all three timeouts.
So it was 2:54. Okay. So I was right. I was reading that correctly. So here's the thing that I find interesting in that situation. You can do that. You have all three timeouts plus you have the 2 minute warning or the whatever you want to call that timeout. So you effectively have four timeouts in this play. But what is paramount in this situation is you have to have a good punt, right? They had one good punt the entire game, guys. One. That was it.
Ozzie. I don't know why you doubted him, Luke.
Oh, first of all, I was dead wrong because when that sequence unfolded, I didn't think they should have punted. And the reason why I didn't think that is because the UCLA quarterback had just gone 7 for 7 on his previous 7 throws. And so in my mind, you're punting the ball back to a white hot quarterback. And yes, they're going to run the ball twice, try to run down the clock. But in my mind, I'm saying he's going to make a play on third down, which he had done against pressure almost all night. So I was dead wrong. It was the right call. They did execute on that punt. It made a huge difference, obviously, because then they took over on the about midfield and the 50-yard line. But one thing I wanted to bring up, so on that drive going in, the screen pass to Lamecki Brockington, I want to talk about why that worked. I think the best...
Are you talking about the third and two?
No, this is on the touchdown drive.
On the final drive. Yep. So I think in my mind, the best halftime adjustment that this offensive coaching staff has made the entire year was in this game. And what they did was UCLA, they were keying on Darius Taylor. They were run blitzing. We've talked about that. So what they did right out of halftime, they started bootlegging and running Darius Taylor to the left in a fake, basically a fake outside zone to the left. And he would carry the linebackers to the left, and then they would bootleg Max out to the right, and they hit Daniel Jackson in the flat. They hit a tight end in the flat. So they were running those linebackers out of the play, and that was opening things up. And that screen pass to Lamecki on the last drive, if you go back and watch that, watch the two middle linebackers. Darius flows out to the left on a outside zone action. They both
run fast enough to the left.
They run. They completely run themselves out of the play. They throw screen back to the right, and it's blocked okay, but he's able to get the first down or 5 or 6 yards only because those linebackers, that's their play. The inside linebackers have to pursue on that inside out and make that tackle, but they're on the other hash because of that adjustment. That was I can't understate it. That was a massive adjustment that the coaching staff made because they, like us, they keyed in on that and said, okay, UCLA they're keying on Darius, they're run blitzing. How do we take these linebackers? Well, you either have to run play action and throw behind the linebackers, or you've got to run them out on boot and get them out of the play, which is what they did. And they put 14 points up right out of halftime because of that, and then went to it later in the game, as we talked about in the Lamecki screen. So that was a huge, as good of a game plan as UCLA had with their defense, which I think was the right game plan, it was a great counter. It was a great chess match to watch this all unfold.
Well, yeah. Even on that play, I do want to note, again, I'm not going to be the one to tell you about the offensive line, but Quinn Carroll on that Lamecki 3rd-and-2 conversion, 2 huge, massive blocks. He's able to turn the play side end on the throwback there, and then a defensive tackle is hustling to try and peel back to get Lamecki from behind. Quinn Carroll has the wherewithal to come off the first block to hit the second guy. And I tell you, if any of the other 3 linemen in space don't focus on one corner on the outside, I'm pretty sure Lamecki walks in for a touchdown. But even so, to your point, Derek, what a gutsy call, by the way. Like, you have to be right on that spot because you cannot play for a field goal the way that Dragon Kesich has been kicking. And to be able to have the confidence. And the funny part is, did you guys, on your rewatch, did you know they showed PJ Fleck before that 3rd-and-2 play? Did you see what he was doing?
Was he kneeling?
Yeah, he was like crouched down playing with the grass. Like, he is so nervous. He's like any other person out there. And he's like, boy, you better be right. And Harbaugh was right. So it's, again, I know it's not the popular thing to do, especially in among this fan base, is to give any of the offensive coaching staff some flowers. But I will say, to Derek's point, it was fascinating to kind of watch the chess match between them. I'm not here to tell you Greg Harbaugh is the next coming of Sean McVay, but I think people have to start appreciating that I will die on the hill of this. If this offense doesn't shoot themselves in the foot, Harbaugh and Max Brosmer are good enough to lead this team into the red zone pretty dang consistently, even with no resemblance of a running game, which, I mean, we haven't talked any about that, Luke.
We got to talk about that. So the Gophers rushed for 41 yards on the day in total.
They have one run over 10 yards.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yep. And you got to give UCLA credit. I thought they were good. But also, Derek, what I found interesting was they seemed to run a lot more inside zone again. Again, they didn't run it a ton, right? I think ultimately they get credited for, 24 carries on the day, but would Max take 3 sacks? I can't remember.
Darius Taylor and Marcus Major had 18 carries.
18 carries. So
Max Brosmer had like 44 dropbacks.
Yeah. So, okay. So ultimately they run some more inside zone, which I found interesting. So what do you think the thought process is there? They come back to inside zone.
Yeah, well, I guess right after I've complimented the offensive coaching staff, I have to give a criticism. I didn't. Maybe there's a good reason for this, but I really thought that they stayed in 12 personnel, 2 tight end personnel, quite a bit more than I thought they should have. I don't think they had a lot of success out of that. They didn't have a lot of success running the ball in any personnel, but because of that, I think they were more apt to run inside zone. The reason I think they went back to that is because with UCLA's linebackers downhill and run blitzing, you're very likely to get a big minus yardage play if you take things outside. So if you run outside zone and one of those guys comes through the B gap, he's going to make a tackle for a 6-yard loss potentially. So it's a risk averse strategy to try and run inside zone, get what you can. That's part of conventional wisdom, is you run right out of zone, because if they miss the gap, you're going to take that thing to the second or third level. They did mix in some power, and they've tried to do that to some degree the whole year, but they finally, in the second half, because they were running that outside bootleg action or running Darius out of the to take the linebackers out, they did go back to some mid zone, and that looked better. I as we sit here today, their best running play this year has been mid/outside zone. Their second best running play this year has been power, and their worst running play this year has been inside zone outside of goal line situation. So it was a little bit perplexing why they stayed in 2 tight end personnel and tried to run more inside zone. But if I had to guess, it was because they knew that the blitz pressure was there and they didn't want to bounce things outside and take a big loss.
Okay. Ultimately, running continues to be perplexing, to say the least.
It's an adventure.
Yeah.
That's the positive tone of it. It continues to be an adventure 7 games into the season.
I think it was exacerbated even more in this game when you can't run the ball by the fact that they couldn't get Darius Taylor or Marcus Major really involved in in the passing game, which has been kind of a de facto run game almost to the quick game, we should say. And they didn't really get a quick game going. Ultimately, they have to be able to find a running game. They have to. Maybe it'll come.
Especially off the bye. I'd also say we got to give Daniel Jackson a little bit of love here. I mean, 10 receptions. He drew a couple of huge pass interferences.
It should have been 11 receptions, but who's paying attention?
Don't get me started on some of these reviews. I would tell you, in the Rose Bowl press box, we had the TVs on, which, great, I can be able to watch replay, but there was two things. There was no sound on the TVs, and there was no sound from the referee's mic into the press box.
Oh, interesting.
Which, I don't know how either one of those... At normal home games for Minnesota, we do not have any TV sound. That's normal. But to not be able to hear what the referee is saying on the field and kind of having to almost check Twitter or look at the scoreboards to see what's going on, that's certainly an interesting way to do it at the Rose Bowl. But Daniel Jackson, 5 contested catch wins, according to Pro Football Focus. That is a new season high for a Gopher receiver. The amount of reviews on some of these Gopher catches or non-catches was interesting. I still don't quite frankly know what's a catch and what's not. I think a lot of it has to do with what the original call was on the field. But Luke, you give your boy from Kansas City a little bit of love.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel Jackson on the day was really good. And he's been really good this season. 10 receptions for 89 yards. He had... What I thought, I was a little surprised that the official that made the call on the one that they end up calling an incomplete, I don't know how he was able to make that assertion from his vantage point that it was a bobble, because the down marker would have blocked his ability to see the actual bobble. So that I found perplexing. But the reality of the whole situation is Daniel has just, he's been very, very good this year. He kind of picked up where he left off last year. His route running's been phenomenal. And then just, it seems like the drops have dropped off. We saw a little bit more of this last year. I hope I didn't jinx him now. I'm gonna knock on some wood. but I feel like he's been more sure-handed. And I don't know, Derek, they're still scheming stuff directly for him, as they should be.
Yeah, I think that combination with Max and Daniel has just gotten better and better with each game. And if I were an upcoming defensive coordinator trying to scheme against Minnesota, that's one that's really tough. That's as good, sustainable, I think, asset that you can rely on if you're Minnesota going forward. Because if you think, I mean, well, Ryan just pointed out with the 5 contested catches, many of the catch and throws that Max and Daniel have had this year, he's not really open. Max is just, he's placing the ball. He trusts him. So he's placing the ball exactly where it needs to be. And then Daniel is able to just make some miraculous catches. So I don't know how you scheme against that. And in fact, in many parts of the second half, UCLA had tightened down the coverage, and they were, again, if they're blitzing and they had a one deep safety that was incredibly deep, so they're going to take away post and things way down the field. But to the sidelines, which is where Daniel got most of his targets, that was tight coverage, and in many cases it was good coverage. But it's tough to defend that when the ball is placed right where it is, and Daniel's going to come away with that. So that's something to lean on going forward, and I think that's something sustainable. I just wanted to add in one comment. We don't talk about the officials a lot on this pod, and I think for good reason, but I don't know what's going on in college football with defensive pass interference. I've watched a number of games outside of Gopher games, and it seems to me, and maybe this was something purposeful in the off season that they're emphasizing, I think there's a lot less defensive pass interference being called, in my mind, and compared to what you're calibrated to previously. I don't know why that is. I think that it's become a factor in a lot of these games where, and frankly, if that's going to be the case, I think that's a strategy you need to employ as a defensive coordinator. Start telling your corners to play handsy and grab, and because they're not calling it most of the time. And it's frustrating as an offensive person watching it, where you see it and you go, well, there's a flag. It's going to be deep. And then they don't call it. And like I said, this is not a Minnesota thing. This is, I think, a trend that I've seen across, and I don't really know what. It's a little bit bizarre to me, but it's become a factor in some of these games.
You know who this benefits largely? This benefits Iowa, like big time. And I will say this, it was not the determining factor of the game against Washington, but they absolutely got away with murder on a couple plays. Like it benefits them probably more than anyone in the league, and you have to give credit to Phil Parker and staff, because it's almost like they teach it that way, right?
They will I'm convinced they will press the officials to make it called, so they will teach their which they should. This is not a criticism, it's a compliment.
It's a compliment.
They will push the envelope, and they will force officials to call if you're grabby. And if they don't call it, and I've often said to you guys offline that if you watch an Iowa game and they don't call a DPI in the first couple possessions, it's going to be a long day for the opposing offense, because it's really, really hard. Iowa's defense is already so good the way it is. If they're not going to call the outside corners grabbing, you're just not going to get anything. I mean, you're not going to get guys downfield. You're not going to win contested catches. And so your chances of getting an explosive against them goes to almost nothing. So yeah, I think it benefits them. But again, I would go back to, if this is something we're seeing, that should be something that all defensive coordinators look at and should be teaching, you know, hey, look, why don't you be a little bit more physical? Why don't you, you know, just don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to grab a jersey, not afraid to slap some hands and grab an arm, because they're just not calling it.
So I got two things, neither refereeing related, unfortunately for you two, but Daniel Jackson, after this 10 catch performance, he is now fourth all time at the University of Minnesota in receptions. He passed one of Luke Buehr's favorite players growing up, Tutu Atwell.
Oh yeah.
He passed him in this game. So he ranks fourth all time with 175 receptions. He is only behind Eric Decker, Tyler Johnson, and Ron Johnson. He is 14 behind Ron with 5 guaranteed games to go, and he is 24 behind Tyler. So if you want to extrapolate that, if he just catches 6 balls in each of the next 5 games, he is going to be the second all-time leader behind Eric Decker. And as we currently sit here today as well, he is 7th all-time at the University of Minnesota. He is just behind Rashad Bateman by less than 100 yards. So if he can get, well, I don't know, 300 more receiving yards in these final 5-6 games, which I think is obviously very realistic, I mean, he could end top 2 in receptions, probably looking at somewhere around top 4-ish in all-time receiving yards. Now, I understand the game is very different than the way it used to be played. You don't have to – I'm not comparing eras here. Just wanted to get that on the record here. But then I also wanted to get, Luke, your thoughts on what do you think of the way P.J. Fleck handled the end-of-game situation with his timeouts? Because we talked about it a little bit, and then I took us off course, and you know that I'm kind of –
as you're one to do.
I am the king of side tangents.
Yeah.
But Minnesota does elect to punt the football. And I understand that, to Derek's point, this was a white hot UCLA team. But you punt the football. Mark Crawford gets a very generous roll. UCLA starts at their own 3. Now, Minnesota's got all 3 timeouts plus the 2-minute warning. So run up the middle, timeout number 1. Run up the middle, timeout number 2. And then Jack Henderson gets right in front of that UCLA defender in space. It gets to 4th and 1. Minnesota elects to use their timeout ahead of the 2-minute warning, which I'm not – I wish Daniel House was here to tell me what the analytics would say about letting it run down versus not letting it run down. But look at what happens, Luke. When you don't burn a timeout for something unnecessary, you actually can use it. It's almost like we're trying to congratulate him for not screwing up like a game situation that was incredibly vital. But is it weird to say Luke Fleck actually did that well?
I think he did. In the moment, I didn't really like the call, mostly because I wasn't confident going into the punt. But if you kind of look at some of the analytics or stats of that, like at that point, UCLA had not run the ball well at all. And, you know, if you're able to pin them back and execute on the punt, you are going to get the opportunity to call timeouts, and they're not going to get yardage. They're going to end up in third and long. Now, to Derek's point, the part that made me most nervous is Garbers was really good. I know he threw three interceptions, but he was really good in that game, especially just some absolute dimes that he threw towards the end there. So that's what in part made me nervous, but the Gophers all game were seemingly able to get pressure on him, and ultimately his feet helped him a ton. But I don't know, Derek, for me, like, I think they made the right choice. It obviously showed in the outcome, but I don't think I was cognizant of just how poorly UCLA was running the ball and how that made sense.
Yeah, I think, again, I was wrong. I didn't think they should have punted, but it absolutely, I think, was the right thing to do. And it worked out exactly the way they wanted it to. To your point, Ryan, about should they – I thought they should have saved the timeout and let the two-minute warning, because then if you go in an offensive possession with a timeout – that allows you to use the middle of the field if you're getting down to the final seconds, and then you can call a timeout to get another shot at the end zone, or worst case, call a timeout to get a field goal if you're really getting down. So, but ultimately, again, everything worked out. I think it was a very, very good use. I was really happy that they had three timeouts at the end of the game and didn't have somewhere earlier in the second half where they needed to use a timeout because so, you know, they didn't have the right personnel out there, or it was an important third down and they didn't get the right look. So the fact that they didn't burn one earlier in the half was just massive, because having those three timeouts worked, as we saw. I mean, they used all but a few seconds to end up scoring. So it was a good, very good job.
All right, let's catch a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk defense. We'll talk special teams. We're going to talk some more penalties because that played a big role in this, and then we'll close it out. Ryan, Home Field Apparel once again is sponsoring Gopher Gridiron Radio. I am wearing one of the shirts right now, Ryan. These are probably the most common shirt that I wear in my entire wardrobe. They are incredibly comfortable. They have the logos are incredible. I've been eyeing a Tulane Green Wave shirt that I think I'm going to get here soon. But I'm telling you, man, this is some of the best stuff. And if you're a Gopher fan, or you're just a college sports fan in general, you got to check out the Home Field Apparel gear.
You know what the funny part is? So Luke, I didn't tell you this last week when I was prior to the game, I was roaming, I think it was the Sky Uma lot. And I was walking over there to see some buddies, and I had a couple of guys stop me, and they were actually wearing Home Field Apparel stuff. And they told me, one guy had the Ope t-shirt on, which is from the Minnesota football box.
Yeah, from the box.
And the other guy, I believe, had on the March on to Victory shirt. And they were big listeners, and we appreciate them. I don't think I ever caught their names because I'm a bad person. But there is always something for you to find that is unique, and it's going to make you stand out amongst a bunch of Gopher fans. So if you haven't already and you got some time to kill on this flight or just walking around Pasadena right now, what I want you to do, go to homefieldapparel.com. Check out the Gopher gear or whatever obscure school that you think they might not have. You are going to find something you like, something unique, something, to Luke's point, is some of the most comfortable Gopher gear that you will own. And then when you put it in your cart and you get to checkout, I want you to use the promo code GG24. That is the two GG and then the numbers 24, and you will get 15% off your first order. That is promo code GG24 at checkout for 15% off your first order.
Ryan, Team Dinkytown Real Estate Group supports Gopher athletes. They support Dinkytown athletes. They support you when you are buying or selling your house. These are experienced real estate agents that cover the state of Minnesota. You know, Ryan, it's just a fact that they've helped some parents, players find places here in the Twin Cities. A portion of those proceeds that would go towards the commission that they would receive are actually going back to Dinkytown athletes to support the athletes and the success of athletics at the University of Minnesota.
And if you're thinking about buying or selling a house, and I think a lot of people are starting to get that inclination with interest rates starting to dive a little bit to where instead of 6-7%, we're getting closer to 5, getting it a lot more easier to be able to stomach, I would say. And if you don't know a lot about the real estate, look, I get it. I'm someone who bought a house just a few years ago. It was very complicated. If you don't have a realtor in your life that you trust and you want to help out your favorite college team in the University of Minnesota, check out the folks at Team Dinkytown. I know many of you have already. TeamDinkytown.com or give them a shout today. 612-250-8562.
All right, let's talk about when the Gophers were on defense on the day. The Gophers give up 17 points. They only allowed 36 yards of total rushing. Great on, really awesome on them, actually. Ethan Garbers was good. They forced three turnovers. He threw three interceptions. The last one, I mean, it's a Hail Mary, right? I don't think that really counts for anything. But then, you know, he was 25 of 36 for 293 yards. He was good. They were able to get pressure, but weren't able to get home a lot. You got to give Garbers credit a lot there. And he was able to make some big throws, but the two interceptions before the final one that Coy Parrish got were obviously one, a great play by Coy, and then another one by Lindenberg to be able to come up with that. And if memory serves, Lindenberg almost had another interception on a tipped ball that correct, he wasn't able to come down with. But all in all, you know, the defense played pretty well. There are a couple instances where you wish they really could have gotten off the field on long third downs, but you got to give Garbers his flowers. But on the day, UCLA was 6 of 13 on third down. They were 1 of 1 on fourth down. They amassed 329 yards of total offense. A little bit more bend but don't break again. But, you know, they're also able to get some pressure. So, Derek, what did you see schematically that the Gophers were able to do successfully?
Well, I wanted to say just like the compliment that we gave the defensive coaching staff for UCLA, I thought the scheme and the game plan for the offensive staff was spot on. I have to give some credit to UCLA. They had watched Minnesota and scouted them and knew that Minnesota runs a high pressure defense, and they were ready for it. So they had a number of plays early in the game where the ball was out quick. So they went to a quick game early, and Minnesota generally is not going to run a lot of man pressures early unless they get down to the red zone. So they were able to hit some zone passes against some zone pressures early because they had game plan for that. So you could picture UCLA's offensive coaching staff working with the quarterback and saying, we're going to work on getting the ball out quickly, getting our quick game, because Minnesota is going to bring pressure. Additionally, I have to give some credit to UCLA's quarterback, as you alluded to, Luke, that his ability to wiggle out of pressure and extend the play was at times a killer. I know that Minnesota was able to get to him, and that was huge when they were able to come up with some sacks and bat a ball down and get an interception, and you know, that's all part of it. But the number of times, particularly on third downs, where he was able to just sidestep or step up in the pocket or just avoid the rush and buy himself another second and a half really was a killer to Minnesota. But on the other side, I think Minnesota realized as the game went on that in they dialed up their pressures in key situations and brought more up the middle and were able to start. And I thought the defensive line, by the way, had a great game, probably their best game of the year, that they were able to get to them. And the fact that UCLA wasn't able to run the ball also made them one-dimensional. I think that that all contributed. But ultimately, this is a defense that I think we saw everything in one game. With a high-pressure, chaos-style defense, you are going to live and die by the success of your pressures. It's going to get you turnovers. It's going to get you minus yardage plays. But it's also going to get you in positions where you're giving up third downs, you're giving up long plays, because if they can extend the play, you're going to give up some chunk plays as well. I think we saw a little bit of it all.
Yeah, it's been an interesting, I'll say, last couple of weeks for the defense, where you look up at the end of the night and they've only given up 17 points, and it feels like it should have been more. But that's where I was talking about this with Derek, Luke. We're going to find out how sustainable all these turnovers are. Now, to Derek's point, on one side of the coin, because you are so high risk and high pressure, you put these college football quarterbacks in tough spots. And mm-hmm. as we've seen, even talented passers like USC and UCLA's quarterbacks, they're putting the ball in harm's way. And Minnesota's back seven has been incredibly opportunistic, and they've been able to come away with huge turnovers. But on the flip side, you've seen on the other side when Minnesota doesn't get multiple turnovers in games, when you think back to, say, the Iowa and the Michigan games, there's a lot of points on the board because it's either a turnover or there's missed tackles and you can't get off the field on third down, of which I mean, we're talking about a UCLA offense on the night that is 6 of 13. I believe Minnesota is giving up 48% of their third downs to be converted against them. That is not where you want to be. So that's where I'm struggling kind of to figure out what this defense is, because it's such a different style than what Joe Rossi had for so many years. And that's what I'm used to covering. But Luke, it's the high risk, high reward. You get Devin Eastern gets pressure, gets a finger on the football, which Devin Eastern, I thought, had his best night of the season,
yes.
Number 91 for Minnesota. Yes. Incredibly impactful in the run game, incredibly impactful as a pass rusher. And he is playing very banged up right now. Tips it, Cody Lindenberg's right there, which, folks, did you notice that number 45? Yeah, played his probably best game of the season, and he didn't have the gigantic, bulky arm brace on, which I asked him about afterwards. And he mentioned how, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, he hasn't really needed it for a while now, but it was a comfort thing. So he thought it was just kind of circumstantial that he maybe played a little bit better without it. But Luke, what do you make of this defense? Because you'll have drives where the opening drive of the game, far too easy, or Minnesota dials up a pressure, doesn't get home, and then Ethan Robinson gets beat on a deep over, where then he kind of cheats at the very end to see if that ball is, if that ball is anywhere near underthrown. He's playing that to jump it and get the interception, but the ball is placed on the money. It's a touchdown.
Yeah.
What do you think of the high risk, high reward Corey Heatherman style of play?
I mean, I think my frustration in the Joe Rossi era was that they didn't turn teams over enough and didn't put enough pressure on them. And if you had a guy out of position, it didn't go well, which we saw. Here, you're able to kind of combat. You're able to combat some of the explosiveness with your own explosiveness by forcing turnovers. To your point, hopefully they can continue to keep this up. But if they don't, it might be bad in the other direction, like we saw against Iowa, right? Ultimately, for my money, I like this approach on defense a little bit more. I think especially with the defensive line that they have, if they can get pressure, I really do like this defense approach more than I would have a Rossi. But, you know, I've been wrong about defense so many times, so who knows?
It takes a big man to admit that. I'm very proud of you, Luke.
Thank you.
This is what you've been going to therapy for. I'm very proud of you. I validate your feelings.
That, among other things, but, you know.
Yeah. This isn't that podcast, but I would say this. I think the defensive line played well? Here's your contrarian opinion. I thought they just played all right. Like, there were individual performances on this defensive line where I mentioned Devin Easter. Thought he played incredible. His best game of the season so far. And you can see what interior pressure from a defensive tackle does. He helped shut down the run game. He was getting pressured, tips a ball, turnover. You look at, I believe, Coy Parrish's interception, where the first one, it's Devin Eastern on the interior and it's Jackson Howard on the edge. They combine for the pressure, ill-advised throw on the wrong shoulder. Coy Parrish dives, interception. I mean, that's what pressure does to these college quarterbacks. I would say, though, they need to get healthy there, because you saw Anthony Smith leave for a moment in time, of which I thought Anthony probably played one of his best games of the season. But you're throwing out some defensive line combos that are very, I'll say, interesting right now. And if they don't get home with some of the bodies that they're throwing out there, that's how you see teams like UCLA sustain drives, which eventually lead to points. So Jalen Logan Redding continues to play on one leg. I think he played less than double-digit snaps, of which not listed on the injury report. Oh, but did you see? We haven't even talked about this. Speaking of the Gopher defense going against the UCLA offense, UCLA had a receiver listed on the availability report.
I did see this. Yeah, and then he played.
Ended up playing.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I've seen this before in the Big Ten availability era. I don't know that I've seen any repercussion come down from the Big Ten quite yet. I say this as we're recording this late on Sunday night Central time, but I'm going to be fascinated to kind of see how they, what they do with UCLA to I guess, slap them on the wrist or hopefully something a little bit more, set a precedent. So as much as it is about the defensive line, they just need to get healthy because Devin Eastern's banged up. Jalen Logan Redding is, Anthony Smith is. You're playing on one leg for a lot of these guys, and if they're going to have a successful between bye week stretch, it's going to be because of Winston's defensive line, Derek.
Yeah, getting healthy is the number one thing for them, and it's important. And just one more note on that style of defense that they want to play. Again, you require a lot of the defensive line. The defensive line is moving post-snap on most snaps. Whether it's a blitz, a stunt, a twist, they're often, and that's part of the reason they're susceptible to giving up chunk plays in the run, because they might get two gaps over, you might have a gap undefended, but they're giving more free rein, but also expecting more out of the defensive line. So I think that makes it all the more important. These aren't just space eaters like they are in a more risk-averse defensive approach, and that just makes it all the more important that they get healthy.
Now, Luke, the thing I kind of want to talk about is, one, Cody Lindenberg played really well, and I was glad to see it. He was consistent with his tackling. He had one of his best pass-rushing performances where they don't ask him to do a ton. He's usually the guy where they'll line up four on the line of scrimmage and say he's lined across from the right guard. He is just trying to get as vertical as humanly possible because there's likely an end, say Ja Joyner, looping back around trying to get pressure in the face. But I thought Cody did a really good job in that game. But that other linebacker position, now that Maverick Baranowski's been out in back-to-back games, and we'll see what his timetable is. I've heard some different things with that injury, and God forbid PJ Fleck talks about injuries to give any sort of update, but that's just doing something into the wind, I'll say. That other linebacker spot is a problem. It was a problem last week. It was a problem against UCLA. And now heading into a bye week, we'll see if Baranowski is able to get healthy. You've seen Joey Gerlach get more snaps. You've seen Eli Mao from Chanhassen get more snaps. But I don't know what the solution is. I'm just telling you, when you look at some of the reasons of why opposing offenses are sustaining drives or getting chunk plays, especially over the middle, I mean, they just got to get better stuff at linebacker, Luke. They just have to.
Yeah, they got to get better stuff at linebacker. They're also banged up in the secondary, too, guys. Aiden Goosby went out.
Number seven, by the way,
he's played well.
Been much maligned over the last couple of years, Aiden Goosby.
But he's been good.
He has given up some big plays, including even earlier this year. But if we're going to talk about those, we also have to talk about, I think the last couple of games have been the best stretch of Aiden Goosby's career.
Yeah.
I mean, he has been flying to the football in the run game. I think Pro Football Focus had him as the top graded tackler for Minnesota in this specific game. You think about that game, or the Coy Parrish interception against USC to end it. Well, who is running stride for stride down the field with the 6'6" USC receiver? That'd be number seven. I'm not here to tell you he's the next Jordan Howden already. I'm just telling you, seven's playing a lot better, and it sucks that he got banged up in this game. Kerry Brown, to your point, Luke, missed this game as well. I'm optimistic that both of them are probably going to be back from Maryland if everything goes well. But, I mean, if we're going to talk safeties, have you, Derek, I'll let you go first with this thing. The pride of Esco, Coy Parrish, four turnovers in the last two games. And yes, the Hail Mary one at the end is essentially thrown right to him and there's nobody around. But who else but number three? He has been playing now, I think, 45-plus defensive snaps each of the last 2 weeks. He is human. He missed a tackle or two in this game. But these are some of the instincts from safety that I haven't seen in my time covering this program from a true freshman in a long time. Would you like to wax poetically about the Eskimo from Esco?
Yeah, there's not much that I can say regarding his athleticism and physical traits that other people haven't said. The thing that has really positively shocked me in a good way is that progression that we've talked about before with young players, they need to understand first what their assignment is on any given play before they can, this is sequential, before they can work on their technique and execution. And then the third part of that is effort. how quickly they're able to and fast and how much effort they're able to give. If you don't know what your assignment is and don't understand what coverage you're in, your technique and your effort don't really matter. And similarly, if you do understand your assignment, but your technique is poor, it doesn't matter what your effort is. What's amazing to me is that he's making plays, which requires him to first understand exactly what the coverage is. He has to know what his technique is. And the third part, which I'm not kidding you guys, sometimes it takes an athlete 2 years to get to that third part where you might say, well, it took him a few games or a few half a season or season just to be able to be comfortable with the play calls and to understand what they're doing. And then it might take another few games or a year or whatever to understand the technique. And then when that clicks, that's when you see a player take a jump. That's what I love about college football. You might see a player that wasn't good enough for a season or two. And then all of a sudden in the third season or whatever, well, where did this guy come from? He's really good. It's college football. He's learned those phases and has finally gotten to that third phase and we're able, Coy, who got here in June, is on that third. He's making plays, which requires him to be good on the first two phases already. And he not only did he get here late, but for most of the season, he hasn't been playing on defense, only special teams. So yes, the physical attributes are there, but I've been very impressed by his maturity and understanding the calls, the coverage, and being able to process all that quickly. And I told Ryan in our pre-production meeting, I think his ability and his instincts to try and make plays like interceptions or knock out a ball or fumble, that's only going to continue going up because I know he's mm-hmm. going to get more and more comfortable with the calls and with the imagine what he's going to play like when he's seen some of these plays run at the college level 15, 20, 50, 100 times. He's seeing a lot of these things for the first time. So it's only up from here.
Yeah. He is a special athlete. There's no question. And he's also just kind of a gamer, right? Like there are just guys that are like that. And man, he is one. And it's a joy to get to watch him. I have definitely seen the hashtags coffee for Coy, all those things going around. So make sure.
If only we had someone on this podcast, Luke, that knew about Dinky Town athletes. And if only Dinky Town athletes knew about Coy Parrish. If only that were a thing, because I'm already getting the tweets, the Gopher Illustrated members. Well, I can't even enjoy it because I know he's going to leave for Ohio State. Yeah, how'd that go the first time around when Ryan Day tried to buy it? Well, excuse me. Let me be explicitly clear. I don't know that Ryan Day tried to buy him a week before National Signing Day. I want to be explicitly clear. Okay. Did Ohio State fly in less than a week before National Signing Day to try and get him? They flew into Duluth. When was the last time the Ohio State head coach flew into Duluth Airport? That's how important he was. So why would he leave? That is my whole thing here to the people who want to be Minnesota sports about it. Coy Parrish is essentially a top three fan favorite on this team, if not the number one on this entire team, and he has played 7 collegiate football games. I mean, you saw him on the USC after the USC game. He's lifted on people's shoulders. I mean, you can say that if he wants to go play for, you know, a national championship contender or somebody throws dumb, silly, stupid money at him, maybe. Or hear me out, the kid from Esco who has a brother that plays down at Mankato for football and a family that is very Minnesotan, again, they're from Esco. He can just stay here in the state of Minnesota and he can be the king. He can be the kid that stayed home. He's hashtag one of us. He's someone that everybody knows by this stage. If you have watched a Gopher football game, you know who Coy Parrish is because you care because he's from the University of Minnesota. If he goes somewhere else, he's still going to be a tremendously talented player. Make no mistake of what I am saying there.
Yep.
But if he stays here, which all indications are, people, he's going to stay here for the next 3 years at least, okay? Like, he can be someone that when they kick off next year against, I forget if it's Buffalo or Northwestern State, you can look out in the Huntington Bank Stadium crowd, and there's probably going to be 1,000 Coy Parrish NIL jerseys sold by maybe Dinky Town Athletes and DinkyTownAthletes.com. But again, I just don't have time for that already. We're sitting here on October the 13th. He's got 4 turnovers in 2 games, and the amount of tweets or emails or smoke signals or Gopher Illustrated posts where it's like, well, I don't want to get my hopes up. He's just going to leave. Can we not? Can we just enjoy the nice things that are here currently from the state of Minnesota, Luke? Am I asking too much?
No, you're not asking too much. I find it interesting that that's also the how do I say this?
It's the Johnny Raincloud Minnesota sports.
Well, it's the excuse to not get involved, right? Or like get into it. You're like, well, I can't get into this because, you know, because nice things go away, or we're eventually going to lose. Like, make your own experience. We talk about this a lot, right? Like, who cares? It's all about the whole experience. Like,
Luke, I talk about this all the time. I was born 1992. I'm a Minnesota sports fan. There are 4 pro sports teams here in town. I have been dead inside since 1992. I haven't even seen a male pro sports team make a championship game. Do not talk to me about what it's like. So when I see something like this, where Coy Parrish is playing out of his mind.
Yeah.
And everybody's rallying around him. The team's won back-to-back games because of performances like his. Yeah, allow yourself to feel something inside. It's called joy. It's called happiness. If you wanted, like, we did this whole... Did people not learn from last year? Now, every case is independent, and I'm not going to ask Derek to comment on this because I know that's a tough spot to put him in. But remember what the whole talk was the entire season last year?
Yeah, there was drink for Darius.
Yeah, it was dope. Well, we can't enjoy Darius. He's just going to leave. Ryan, I don't even know why you're talking about his touchdown, Ryan. He's just going to leave. Yeah, and guess what he's doing right now? Catching game-winning touchdown passes because the fine folks and the fine supporters of Dinkytown Athletes can have comparable packages. I feel like I'm putting some words in mouths here, and I'm not, but it's just, allow yourself to be okay that you just say you are one of the 12,000, 15,000 Gopher fans that went out to Pasadena. And we'll talk about you guys at the end of the podcast because, Luke, I want to kind of clue you in on how cool it was out there.
Yeah. But,
like, allow yourself to enjoy the nostalgic win in the Rose Bowl. You just watched your Golden Gopher team. Yeah, it'd been 62 years since they'd been there. Okay. 62 years. Yeah, in UCLA, not the greatest of football teams. But they came from behind and they won a football game, and you got to experience that moment with your friends and your family and everybody texting you back home and the people in the Rose Bowl Stadium. And that is a moment I can assure you so many Gopher fans won't forget. Stop allowing the negative Nancys and the Johnny Rainclouds to steal your joy. Make your own dang joy. And I'm going to step off the soapbox so we can continue to talk about the defense.
Anything else, Derek, you want to talk about the defense?
Sorry, Derek. I probably put words
no. where I shouldn't. No. No, that's and I'll have some few words when we talk about the fans at the end. I'll contribute to that. But I agree with you, Ryan. It's just don't let the future ruin your enjoyment of the present. I mean, that's the bottom line. We had Coy autograph some pictures of his game sealing interception against USC for our Dinkytown Athletes members. And look, we're always going to have that. That game's not going to change. Those that enjoyed it and stormed the field, or those that went out to the Rose Bowl, you have those memories. That's not going to change. This is football. There's NIL and transfer portal. There's also injuries. There's things change all the time, and we can't control that. So I appreciate your you putting that in, Ryan, just because I think it's an encouragement for people to enjoy the moments as we have them. So.
My filter is just so far gone from my lack of sleep. I would say this, Luke. I think the only other thing I want to add is I didn't think it was the greatest days for your corners.
No, I didn't think Ethan Robinson played particularly well.
He in coverage struggled. UCLA missed one in the first half in Ethan Robinson's direction. The ball was thrown too wide. The second one, yeah, you want to have him be in a better spot, but I also just think UCLA is also a Big Ten team, and they have Big Ten quality players.
Also, as a dot, like it was
a great throw. And UCLA is, again, they're still Big Ten athletes on the other side. They may not have had a lot of success, but they're still Big Ten athletes on the other side. And then I did kind of gloss over Anthony Smith a little bit, 2.5 tackles for loss. He and Devin Eastern were the difference makers up front. I thought Ja Joyner might have played his best game in the run game, which we've been begging for that for some time. But I also know, Luke, as much as it is about the offense and defense, guess what time it might be.
All right, so let's get into the special teams. I've been loathing this the whole time.
I know you do.
Okay, well, let's talk special teams, and we got to talk penalties because this
special teams, penalties, Pasadena. We got some things to cover.
All right, so special teams. Do you happen to know the EPA discrepancy here?
Oh God, it couldn't have been good. I know I was pre-writing this before Minnesota took the lead, but it. My guess. So for context, people. In Minnesota's three losses this season, what Luke is going to be referencing is expected points added from the special teams. And I know in the three losses combined, special teams had been a negative 18 in those three losses. And considering a missed field goal, considering very inconsistent punting, and more special teams penalties, which be still my beating heart, I'm going to say like negative 5.
Yeah, so the Gophers were at minus 5. UCLA was a minus 3, so the net difference was a minus 2. It really wasn't as far off. But the missed field goal is really what killed the Gophers.
Well, here's what I'll say. Luke, people like when there's two sides of the coin here. And I guess if I have to be the negative one per se, I'll start with that and you can kind of bring it back around positively. I don't know what to do about Dragan Kesich. Now, I don't get to make those decisions. And look, I can't say enough good things about him as a kid. I mean, he's one of the best personalities on the team, one of the best personalities in my 13 years of special teams since, say, Pete Mortel. And he had an outstanding season last year. Missed 4 kicks the entire year, Big Ten kicker of the year. But now he's missed 6 kicks, and they've all been to the right. And he's missed 6 kicks in which, yes, and I know Luke will tell you on the flip side that some of these have been from 50-plus, and that's a very difficult thing to make for a college kicker. But he's also 3 of 8 from 40-plus. And I said this on Twitter going into that final drive for Minnesota. We're now at a point where you can't trust the field goal kicker. You can't. I mean, you couldn't play for a field goal on that final drive. No doubt in my mind you could not. Because what propensity have we shown from the 2024 version of Dragan Kesich that it's going to be consistent? And I don't know why it's inconsistent. I'm sure Dragan doesn't know. Bob Ligaszewski, the special teams coordinator, doesn't know. But heading into the bye week here, I mean, I'd argue no player on this roster needs more of a mental reset and to kind of take his mind off it, maybe try something different into the bye week to get right to go into that Maryland game, because 6 missed kicks is the most of any, I believe, Big Ten team. And it almost cost them the game here. It already cost them a game earlier. Now, Luke, I understand I am speaking out of both sides of my mouth to an extent where I just yelled at the Johnny Rainclouds when talking about players leaving. And then I'm talking about the kicking situation. And what would be the optimistic point of view, or what would be something that you would tell to someone like myself who has the point of view that I have right now?
Well, I mean, if you look at last year, he was kicker of the year, right? He ended up being 85%, right. 23 of 27. You know, in the majority of his misses, actually, he had one miss in the 30 to 39 range, and then he had 2 misses that were 50-plus. One miss that was 50-plus.
He was 8 of 10 from 40-plus.
Oh, I was looking at the wrong line. I'm sorry. He was 8 of 10 from 30 to 39. He was 5 of 6 from 40 to 49, and then he was 3 of 4 from 50 plus. But the point I want to make is last year he had 10 attempts greater than 40 yards, right? He had 6 in the 40 to 49 and he had 4 in the 50 plus. If you look at this season so far, yeah, his percentage isn't good. He's 53.8% in total, but he's already got 8 attempts of 40 plus, right? So he's 1 of 3 from 40 to 49 and he's 2 of 5 right now from 50 plus. I would argue that maybe some of those 50 plus ones, maybe they shouldn't have been kicking. You know, PJ has said numerous times he has all the confidence in the world in him. And I believe him because I think that right now the stats in the number of attempts would show that. It's very clear, at least to me last year. I don't know if it's a function of the offense in, you know, maybe scoring more touchdowns or not getting close enough to even be in field goal range. But they're putting him out there, and he, yes, he hasn't executed, but they're putting him out there in, I would say, lower probability situations.
I hear what you're saying. I would just say, like, I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle between us.
Yeah. I think the bad one is the miss against North Carolina that was in the, you know, in between 20 and 29.
In that instance were killer. And I mean, even in this last game, I think, what was it? 43 yards,
yeah,
42 yards. Now I'm not incredibly sure. Now he kicks it over the upright, of which we saw some, that same scenario happened twice in the Iowa Washington game, which I will also say, does Kinnick Stadium have the lowest uprights of any stadium you've ever seen?
I did think that.
Goodness gracious, those things look like they're not very high off the ground at all, but I'm getting sidetracked. So I just would say this. I mean, I hope he can find it here in these final five games, because there is going to come another point. I can guarantee in the very near future, for these next three games, of which, Luke, you'll know this, I believe I coined coin flip games. And what's going to come down to?
Yeah.
A kick here and a kick there. They need their all Big Ten kicker to figure it out, because if he can't and he misses, say, another kick, in my opinion, at that point, you just have to see if there's other internal options. And I hate to say that. I truly do, because he's a great kid.
Yeah. But that's where I question
personal, just business.
Yeah, I'm sure. But that's where I question it. If you compare it to the rest of the Big Ten, there's only one kicker, even in his stratosphere in terms of attempts, right? And that's the kicker from Michigan. And he's 4 for 4. And he is, I think, the best kicker in the country, probably. Like, he's probably going to be a pro, right? Nobody else has more than 2 attempts over 50 yards. It's basically Dragon and this guy from Michigan. And, and you know, I didn't do the math on the 40 plus. I just don't think he's that bad. I gotta imagine he'll find a way, but I get where you're frustrated, because, you know, in this game, it could have been the difference. And I think the other really frustrating thing is that against North Carolina, it could have been the difference as well. Did he miss against Michigan?
It would have been the difference. Again, it's not the end all be all of why they lost that game, because the offense and the defense also played incredibly,
but it would have
incredibly
been
sloppy. But you make either one of those kicks and that game changes on its head.
Yeah.
So I want him to find it, because I want the story to be the comeback, and, you know, he hits a big kick here in between the byes. But I also got to deal in reality too, where it's like, he's 7 of 13. And yes, Luke, he's 2 of 5 from 50 plus after being 3 of 4 from last year, but he's still got 3 misses within 49 yards. And it's just,
but that's,
it's something that has to be figured out.
Yeah. And I would say that generally speaking, that in, you know, having 3 misses inside 40 yards.
But more importantly, maybe you would know, again, all 6 misses have been to the right. It's like a mental thing at that point.
That was the thing I wanted to comment about. That's the only thing I have to add to the discussion is, in my experience as a player, you have the kickers and punters go off and do their own thing during practice. But usually towards the end of practice, you have kicking sessions with the team. And you see all the kickers kick. So it's not just the starter. You've got usually 2 or 3 punters, 2 or 3 kickers. And in my experience, the guys who just aren't good enough, they lack consistency. So they miss right, they miss left, they miss short. They're not consistent. To me, there's something to the fact that he's missing the same way. Now, if he knew what it was, obviously he'd have it corrected, and people are saying, well, who cares? He's missing him. Well, to me, I think it's less of a problem that he's missing it the same way. If he were all over the place, now I think you've got a really bad problem. Luke, I don't know what your insight is. I'm curious what your insight is into that. But to me, I think that's, I don't know if he'll get it corrected, Ryan. I certainly hope he does. But to me, it's more correctable because of the fact that he's missing the same way.
I don't have as much of an issue with the you're missing right thing, because to your point, it's like there's something that's going wrong in that. The one thing that I I pointed to, I maybe pointed this out earlier to you guys, I can't remember if we recorded it or not, was the long snapper did change, right? And so that is a variable.
Now a true freshman in the operation going to Mark Crawford is the holder, which remains.
Yeah, but that is a difference because it's all about, it is about timing, right? But at this point, I have a hard time buying that. I
can look at all the holds to see, to your point, if the snap has been a little erratic, and then because of that, maybe the timing is a little bit off. I'm open to any and all suggestions. I'll say that of how this thing goes.
Yeah, just to put it in context, though, like right now, if you're looking at the Big Ten for kickers, like the Big Ten kickers, the top four are really good, right? They're all 100%. Or top three, they're all 100%, but you currently have six guys above 90% right now, which is really good. There wasn't a guy that finished the year last year above 85% or above 86%. Everybody was 86% or below. So Dragan could come back from this. Like, it is possible. I hope I'm gonna say something really sound really silly. I hope he doesn't, because that means we're scoring touchdowns, right?
So I was gonna say there's a joke in there about us not relying on our kicker, meaning we're gonna be more aggressive on offense. I was gonna mention that.
Yeah.
The offense can just stop shooting themselves in the foot once they get across, say, the 35-yard line with drops and penalties and et cetera, et cetera. Yep, yeah. I'm here. I hear you.
Yeah,
I hear you.
I mean, you can look at like last year, you know, I don't know. In general, I just think that we don't want to be kicking field goals. I get the frustration there, especially because it is part of what costs you a win. But all in all, I'm interested to see how they deploy him, if they continue to have the same confidence in him. And I also want to talk about penalties, because penalties are a big part of this game. Ryan, did you look at the penalty EPA in this game?
I didn't see the EPA, but I would tell you, I wrote after the game, just why Minnesota won this game. You're plus three in the take give. Your offense doesn't give the ball away. Your defense takes it away three times. And then on the day, I know UCLA had over 100 penalty yards, including in the second half, they had 8 penalties for 85 yards. So I would imagine they got absolutely decimated. UCLA did an EPA on penalty.
Yeah, so yeah, they did. The Gophers were a positive 5.54 to UCLA 0 in penalties, meaning that Minnesota, you know, effectively could have added over 5 points just in penalties alone in this game. It brings to a broader question. We don't talk about officiating a ton, but I want to bring this tweet up. I think I might have sent this to Derek. But Joe Klatt tweeted, generally speaking, the officiating in college football is really bad. Very little consistency across the board. Having a national officiating body rather than each conference having their own body would be a good start to fixing the problem. I'm not suggesting that's a solution, but I have felt like the officiating this year has been, and it's both ways, fellas. Like, it across college football, it's been a struggle. In this game, I thought it was another big struggle. It wasn't the spotting struggle we had in the Michigan game, but like I'll say the one penalty I thought that was just like really silly was pulling the guy off the pile. Like, that was in the Gophers' favor. I thought that was absolutely asinine. Not to mention the number of DPI misses. I just did not think it was particularly good. But the other reality is the Gophers were the more disciplined team, and that helped them win this game. And had UCLA not had those penalties, this very well could have been a different game, Derek.
I would have been an exponentially different game. I mean, 8 penalties for 85 yards in that second half alone. You look at those first couple of drives, why does Minnesota score in the second half? Their biggest play, I'm pretty sure, on both drives was a UCLA personal foul, and then Minnesota just grinded it from there. So being a disciplined team, of which, Derek, historically, Minnesota has been one of the most disciplined teams in terms of penalties per game in the country and in the Big Ten under PJ Fleck. And in this instance, this is the game that you can point to when your friends ask you, well, what does it matter? Well, it mattered in this UCLA game, and it played a gigantic part of why they ended up winning.
Yeah, I think 2 weeks in a row, it was a big factor in Minnesota's favor. In the USC game, they definitely didn't have as many penalty yards, but they had a handful of really key penalties against go against USC in that game as well. I'm not saying they weren't penalties that were called, you know, wrongly. I'm just saying they had a number of misfires penalty wise as well. So 2 weeks in a row, it's come back to bite you. I think you bring up an interesting point, Luke. I don't have any grand answers, but I will just say, you know, the advent of replay has helped quite a bit, particularly in end of game and end of half situations.
Yes.
I don't think games are being decided on one play anymore. That's a bad call, or at least less, certainly less. But now I feel like replays are getting, they're not getting calls right on some replays, which is odd. I think it's just sloppy, to be honest. And I guess I would agree overall. I haven't been a fan of college officials my whole life, to be honest with you, but replay has cleaned up. Yeah, well, replay has cleaned up a lot of it, but I feel like the last year or two, I think we are going backwards. I don't know why that is, but it just seems like inconsistency. I mentioned the DPI thing, the camera angles we mentioned, which was interesting. Now you're relying on replay, but if you don't have the correct angles, you're only going to be as good as the angles you can see on replay. It's just getting a little bit convoluted, and I think it is a factor. I don't know, again, that it's just that's the one and only thing that's deciding some of these games, but I would agree overall that it's sloppy. And the reason why I haven't been a fan, to complete my thought on that, as a player and a coach, the officials drive you nuts because the players and coaches put thousands of hours into preparation, and then the officials, they're doing the best they can, but let's be honest, they're not putting the same effort into, and they have huge control over the outcome of games. So that's why I've never been a big fan, is just you're relying on people that have not put as much preparation into it, and they're having to decide, you know. So I don't know what the answer is, if it's trying something else and creating a unified body across college football, if that would help, sure, let's do that. There's plenty of money to go around and fund that, so maybe that's worth a try.
I think the consistency conference to conference was always really perplexing to me. And you know, every conference, I think, argued, especially the what was Power 5 and is now Power 4, but maybe it's really only Power 2. They all claim that theirs has the worst officials. And I'm not trying to just like completely rag on officials, but the consistency thing is the part that I probably find the most frustrating. And I think Joe Klatt brings up a really good point that he, you know, the consistency has just not been there. And, you know, having something centralized is at least something worth pursuing. I think that could be a benefit, you know, to this, what do they call it? The Rudy, what was
Project
that?
Project Rudy?
Rudy? Yeah. That could have been one of the good things that came out of that. Otherwise I'm not on that proposal idea. Let's not bring in private equity money into this situation.
Which is why the Big Ten and SEC commissioners essentially said, we're just probably going to steal their ideas and not involve private equity. And we're going to figure out the best thing for us.
Yeah.
But I'd say this, is there anything else you guys really want to talk about this game?
No,
I do want to kind of talk about the Pasadena experience here.
Yeah, I think you were there firsthand. I'm very curious to get your perspective, because Derek and I got to live it through kind of social media and, you know, messages from people that were going to be out there.
So I first want to start with just the Rose Bowl game experience itself. Now, I understand this isn't the Rose Bowl, Ryan. This isn't the Rose Bowl game, the one that everybody had been waiting for. But I'd say this. It was one of the strangest in-season atmospheres I can remember in my 12 or 13 years of doing this. The only thing I could think about during the entire game was, especially after last week, where last week for me, I was sitting in the press box. They sold out Huntington Bank Stadium. The fans were going insane. The student section was incredible. The atmosphere was great. It felt like, and this is probably going to be a poor example, it felt like a professional basketball game, and not like that was the kind of atmosphere where they had like a play by, like they had somebody down on the field trying to like get people hyped.
Okay.
And it was a late arriving crowd for UCLA, and there were plenty of Gopher fans there. Trust me, I heard them. They were very loud. But it was, I don't know how else to say it, but just kind of like odd, where it felt like if you don't think it's professional basketball, fine. But it felt almost like a bowl game, where Minnesota was probably, compared to UCLA fans. Now, For those of you who did travel, the number that got up to us in the press box was 42,000 tickets that were sold. I don't know how many butts were in the seats, probably closer to 35. And I'm going to guess it was more 60-40 UCLA versus Minnesota. But I would argue Minnesota's 40% were louder than UCLA's 60%. I'll tell you, boys, the ability to look out over the Rose Bowl on the mountains and even walking up to the stadium, that was 10 out of 10. It was everything I think every Gopher fan hoped for when they made the trip out to Pasadena. But Luke, did it sound that way in terms of on the TV broadcast? Because
no,
yeah, I don't have it. I'm telling you, it was one of the, it felt like a bowl game with the amount of apathy and empty butts in the seats, because I believe it is a 90,000 seat stadium. And when it's only maybe 40-50% full, it's a lot different. But does that kind of convey accurately what I was trying to see there?
You know, it's interesting that it's good to get your perspective, because I don't think the TV really did it justice how loud the Minnesota fans were. You could kind of tell it was at times that it would be loud, but that's good to know that they were making an impact on the game.
Maybe it was just from where we were situated in the press box. There were Gopher fans underneath us. I know the other big section was directly out across from us by where the Gopher tunnel was. I'm telling you, it felt like a bowl game in the middle of October, which I for whatever the reason was, I didn't expect.
Did you see Darius Taylor's comments though? He said it kind of felt like a home game to them.
I'm telling you, I thought Minnesota was louder than UCLA's fans, and that's a credit to that fan base who traveled, of which, so my wife came with on the trip. And she's not the biggest sports fan in the world. I think both of you are very well aware of that. But she made the comment to me throughout the trip, and even when we got back to the Twin Cities here this morning, she has never seen that much maroon and gold take over a city the way that Minnesota did in Pasadena. Now, we stayed in downtown Pasadena. We went to the Soda Social on Friday night. I know I met a lot of you, and I'm very appreciative that you guys came up to me and Guardzi and, you know, spend some time with us. That was really cool. But I'm telling you guys, anywhere I went in Pasadena, there was maroon and gold somewhere throughout the entire time from when I flew in Thursday night all the way until my 6 a.m. flight this morning on Delta out of LAX, which was 75% Gopher fans. I kid you not. I know I talked with some U officials out there. I know some of them were trying to say 15,000. I'm a bad guesstimator with something like that, but I'll say this. I haven't seen a Gopher fan base like that, so enthused and happy to be there.
Yeah.
And just the amount of joy that people had at the Soda Social or just at coffee shops or bars or restaurants, wherever I was running into people, like, it was one of the coolest experiences to see as someone who covers this team. And I think that, I mean, Luke and Derek, you guys, I think this kind of goes back to, you know, when this all got started, because there was always this stereotype that maybe
Minnesota didn't travel. Yeah.
That Minnesota doesn't travel. You know where it started was that Citrus Bowl.
Yeah. With Jerry
back. Kill.
Yeah.
And where there was 20,000 fans that made their way down to Florida. You've seen them now travel to Colorado, where there were 10,000 Gopher fans. Again, Minnesota officials are trying to say 15,000 for Pasadena. I will just say it was one of the coolest experiences to see old and young and just everybody having the cognizant awareness that I don't know when this is going to come back. Now, Minnesota does go there, and I think a handful of years just because of the way the schedule sets up, but it had been 62 years. So you saw people from their mid-80s all the way to 1 and 2 year olds out there and every generation in between. But I want to commend the amount of Gopher fans that did travel, because I have gotten that comment from on the record players, off the record players, coaching staff, that they knew Minnesota was going to travel well, the fans, but their ability to impact that game or just even impact that community in Pasadena is just something that I know a lot of people aren't going to forget. So for those of you who did make the trip out there, I think it was very much worth your while.
Yeah, and I know I talk about this a lot, But I really think one of the things that's incredible about sports is that you can create shared experiences together, and you can create memories and bonds. It's no fault of our own that we have this podcast together. This silly football team brought us together, right? And we've met a number of people, you know, through the process of, you know, going to games and just being Gopher fans, right? And I think that's what's one thing that's fun, just fun about sports in general. But it was really, really fun for me to be able to, you know, flip through Twitter or whatever it was and see some of the pictures of people having a great time, whether it's at the tailgate or Lesotho Social or at the game or after the game. And I hope somebody got late night tacos at a taco truck, you know, like just like experiencing what LA and I guess Pat more specifically Pasadena has to offer is awesome. But more importantly, you got to do it with other Gopher family and friends. That's just wonderful. And I think that it's great that Minnesota is continuing to build a culture of being able to travel. And I do think that PJ Fleck deserves some credit for that, because he's been able to at least manage the expectations or set an expectation that this team is, you know, competitive, right? And they have been competitive. They have had some high points. They've had some low points as well. But all in all, I think the interest has probably not been higher in my lifetime than it has been in his tenure as the head coach. So I'll kick it to you, Derek.
There are so many things about college football that are fun and unique that don't have anything to do with the outcome of the game.
100%.
And I think that a lot of that, for whatever reason or whatever excuse or whoever we want to blame, has been missing in this market. And it's been really fun to see. I feel like our fan base is discovering that. They're discovering how fun the tailgating experience can be. They're discovering how fun a night game can be at Huntington Bank Stadium. They're discovering how fun a maroon out or a stripe out can be. They're discovering how fun away game experiences, bowl game experiences, all of these things. The key word you mentioned, Luke, is competitive. Yes, you must be competitive. It helps to be competitive. But all of these things that are unique to college football and these experiences that are really fun, and it doesn't require you to even be a huge avid fan of football. It's experiences with friends. And the number of texts that I got, and some of the coolest were people that I knew in different social circles who ran into each other on the trip and said, I met so-and-so who knows, you know, a family member of yours. And then they were hanging out, and that was, you know, social media was cool to see too. But the number of texts of people who met and struck up a relationship and had fun, whether it was for the Soda Social or for a pregame tailgate, was really cool. These are the type of things that college football can bring to you. You get to experience these different cities. Now we've got a fan base that many of them traveled to North Carolina. They were at Colorado. They maybe were at the Outback Bowl. Now they were at the Rose Bowl. I mean, how cool is that? You get all of these different, and then all the home game experiences. So that's been really fun and rewarding for me as a fan and alumni member to see our fan base kind of enjoying that along with them, that discovery.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point. And I appreciate you saying that. You know, there's so much to being a fan that's not even about the game and the outcome, right? And that is fun. I would love to see the Venn diagram of how many people went to that Colorado game, right? Because I think in some ways that was a surprise of how many people showed up. And then they ended up going to this one because they enjoyed that experience in Colorado so much. One thing that I'll mention is I will be at the game when Washington and the University of Minnesota play each other for the first time in Seattle. That I will be at that game. I hope many of you will join. That is a fantastic city. It is a fantastic
venue. Luke is going
venue.
To be, for the record here, he is saying explicitly on record in 2026 when the Gophers travel to Seattle, he's going to rent out a sailboat for a sailgate that is going to be Luke Buer sponsored. You've heard it here first.
I don't know if that'll happen. Some things are going to have to go right in life for that to happen. But in general, folks, like, it's a great venue. It's going to be much harder to get tickets, though. Like, this situation where, you know, UCLA is not particularly good, it was a wonderful thing for Gopher fans because they didn't have to be, have super competitive tickets. you know, in Seattle, they have a good football, college football culture, and tickets will be harder to come by, but make sure you get out there. It's just a wonderful venue. I've seen many games in Husky Stadium, I'm excited to watch my Gophers play there, even though I'm also torn exponentially by the fact that there is no more Pac-12. I'm so still very sad about that. But Ryan, you got to experience Pac-12 after dark. Big 10 after dark, we should call it.
It was. I know it. I know that one hit the group chat at some point. Big 10 after dark. Yeah, it's been a whirlwind of a 72 hours, but I just wanted to convey that for all of you that made it out, and if you know you came up and said hi and whatnot, we appreciate you more than you know. And just to be able to see the fan base travel like that, just as a member of the media, again, I can't tell you the amount of player parents or coaching staff or whoever it may be that they noticed, and it made a difference to them. So if you thought you showing up to that game might not matter to somebody, know that it certainly did. And I hope that the memories were everything that you wanted and more.
Yeah, let's keep this momentum going. Obviously, the Gophers have won two in a row. They swept LA, and you know they found their way back to 500.
We'll be back out there at the end of the week to do some recruiting, which if you want to know more about that, what is the website? I'm glad you asked, Luke. It's gopherillustrated.com.
Yeah, so the Gophers find their way to 500 in the Big Ten. They're 4-3 on the season. They will welcome, Maryland for homecoming? And
after a bye week, baby, bye week number one. Reminder, folks, there's two bye weeks this year.
That's right. There's two. We will have an episode during the bye week. So come back for that. But again, want to thank you all for listening, and go Gophers.